ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Advertising. We see it everywhere we go when visiting websites. Ads for everything. New cars, clothing, movies, food stores, and banks. You name it. You'll find someone trying to sell you something every step of the way. But although they may be ubiquitous, are all of those online ads effective? On this edition of UWM Today, we meet an expert who studies why and how people engage with online advertising. And maybe most importantly, what makes one of those ads work while others don't. Joining us in the studio today is Purush Papadla, professor of marketing at UWM's Lubar School of Business. Purush also recently was named co-director of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute at both UWM and Marquette University. Welcome, Purush. Great to have you in the studio with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I'm very happy to be here.
You have spent much of your life analyzing why people do what they do when they see advertising. Fascinating, because it really is all around us, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And there's a lot of data that shows that, on the average, a citizen in the country today is exposed to at least 4,500 commercial messages every day. And that includes ads on the internet, ads on the radio, ads on billboards, ads in the mail, ads in the newspapers, ads in magazines, ads on the phone when you answer the phone. Everything together, on the average, it's 4,500 messages that we're exposed to every day.
The goal, of course, is to get people to do something, ideally to spend money.
Typically, I mean, clearly there's a lot of interest in getting people to do things other than spending their money. So, for example, there could be public health campaigns. So, for example, there has been a campaign that has been going on for 10 years now, almost 10 years, that attempts to reduce the practice of texting while driving. There's some data that shows that that practice costs between $120 to $200 billion per year.
So not all ads are bad. Some of them have great intentions.
Exactly.
All of the ads today on the web, it seems to me, are aimed not at a general audience, but it seems like they're following me, Purush. I'm not paranoid, I think all of us have had that experience where if you are online looking at suits or at shoes, you can pretty much expect in the next day or two that somewhere in your online activity, up is going to pop an ad for shoes or suits.
Yeah, that's not a surprise, because that's the core principle on which marketing has always been run. It's called targeting. So targeting is all about reaching the right customer with the right message about the right product at the right time. The difference now is that in the past, doing that was extremely difficult, because you did not know which customer was looking for what product at what time and where he or she was. Today, as we go online more and more, and as we look for things, or as we show interest in things, or maybe show that we're not interested in some things, all of the data is being collected through the clicks from our keyboard or on our phones. And the data is stored and the data is analyzed to figure out who should be told what. And so it's not surprising that you're seeing all of those, and there's a big science behind it.
And of course, we're going to talk a little bit later about the Northwestern Mutual Data Institute, but there again is a sign that large companies, large international companies like Northwestern Mutual, have a great desire to understand how to utilize that data better than they have in the past.
There is, and it's imperative for companies today, because those that do not fear, and rightly so, that they would be left behind because their competitors are. So no company can afford today, regardless of how small or big it is, what type of product or service it is in, and essentially whatever its business is, whether it's for-profit or not-for-profit, to not take a close look at data and use the data to improve its business and marketing practices.
You've spent a lot of time over the last few years looking at social media.
Yes.
And specifically platforms like Facebook and Twitter, Instagram. What have you learned in your research on the ads that are placed on those online sites?
Sure. If I were to summarize all of my research and all of the findings in 30 seconds or less, the key finding is very simple, that given the amount of time that we are spending on so many different things online, social media, on our phones, in our jobs, with our family, we really do not take time to process any message that comes at us. So you might be getting all of these ads coming at you, but I'm sure if you sit back and think about it, you would realize that you really did not pay attention. So the only way that businesses can actually get across their message, ironically, despite the fact that they can target you with so many messages, is to make sure that whatever message you're sending them is unique enough, is different enough, that you would sit up and take note. That's the key message, and everything is driven by that.
So what is the secret sauce? What will make me or you or our family members look at one message? Well, as you said a moment ago, we ignore a lot of the others.
Sure. So the secret sauce, once again, to summarize it in a few words, is that the message has to be unique. And what that unique means is clearly dependent on the medium in which that message is placed. So if you're talking about a medium like a visual medium like Instagram or a banner ad online, it has to be unique in terms of the visuals it carries. If it's a text-based ad, so for example, you're tweeting or something on Twitter, it has to be uniquely constructed. If it's an audio ad, it has to be unique in terms of how it sounds. So everything is about that uniqueness that makes people say, oh, that's interesting. Let's take a look at this. And that 1 second can make a big difference. And that's what my research shows.
Is there anything in online ads that you can be pretty certain won't work? Things that you should avoid if you are a marketer and you want to go ahead and sell your product or service?
Well, you certainly do not want to send an ad that looks like everyone else's ad. You know, in the past, it used to be the belief that imitation is the best form of flattery, right? Now it's not. Imitation is the best way to commit suicide if you're a business. You have to be different. And to expand on that idea, in the past, it was enough for a business to be different and unique with its products. If you had a better mousetrap, they would come knocking on your door. But now you have come to a point where even if you have a unique mousetrap, you have a unique way of telling the customer that you have a unique mousetrap. Unless those two uniques are put together, your unique mousetrap is not going to get known and no one is going to come for it.
A lot of advertisers spend a ton of money hiring famous people, celebrities, to provide that endorsement of, mm-hmm. of the product. Mm-hmm. Are those effective?
They used to be. And I'll tell you why I said they used to be. They used to be effective because, once again, of the fact that going back to the principle that we just talked about, that your ad had to be unique, if you were able to get a celebrity that was in your ad and no one else's, given the fact that it was a celebrity, the celebrity would attract attention, and hence your message would get processed. But today, the wheel has gone, or the pendulum, if you will, has swung in the other direction, where in a lot of cases, particularly with the younger consumers, celebrity presence is actually counterproductive because consumers are moving away from what they see as a celebrity type product. They want to be very subtle. Celebrity endorsements or celebrity products are seen as if you will, loud and not the in thing to do. That's not a universal sentiment. It still works in the case of, say, for example, some sports products. So a famous celebrity sports star endorses a product, it works. But for a lot of other products, it's no longer good to rely on celebrities. Instead, you want to go to consumers. And the reason for that is that celebrity endorsements have been used for so long and marketing has become so ubiquitous, as you said, that consumers have come to a point where they just shut everything out. So if a celebrity appears in an ad, they know right away that, they're being sold something. So how do you get through to the consumer? Avoid the celebrities and have another consumer talk to your consumer and say, hey, you know, I love this product. And the reason that that would work is that if you, as a friend of mine, tell me that you like a product that you bought, I can trust you because I know that you're not getting anything by selling me the product. So that's the, actually the better way to go now than to go through celebrities. And that has actually given rise to a big segment of non-celebrities but celebrities that are called influencers. So the big name on social media today is to be able to market your products through influencers who are not celebrities, but who have their own followers who trust them because they're not trying to sell them. Interestingly, that also has come to a point where the followers of those influencers are seeing that they're trying to sell them something, and that is also becoming less effective.
Good Lord. It's like we become immune.
We have become immune.
Thousands of
yes.
ads, right?
Yes, yes.
What's an advertiser to do?
Well, once again, the advertiser has to, I think it's, today we've come to a point where, as I said earlier, your ad itself has to be so unique that people are, in a way, forced to sit up and take note. So in other words, advertising has to be almost like entertainment in its own accord. So you're entertaining the consumer. So consumers are looking for something entertaining. They look at an ad that's different, that's unique. They say, ah, that's interesting. And they look at it. And so the key today to effective advertising is to find that something that gives it that uniqueness and it prevents people from turning away from it.
So those quirky video clips, those pre-rolls that you see before you watch or you get to watch that video that you went to YouTube for, if they're produced in an offbeat, maybe oddball fashion, they
yes.
may be
yeah, that's
able to hook you in.
Sure, that's a good way to put it, in offbeat and oddball fashion. Or another way would be to produce them in a way that's different from what others do, right? So in a way, they have to be surprising. The more you're able to surprise the consumer, the more you're able to catch his or her attention. And that small 1 second that you're able to hold that consumer's attention for can make a huge difference.
If I'm a listener right now and I have a company or work for a company that makes things, which approach would work best? To show that car, to show that piece of clothing, or to show a person who's wearing it, who's actually using the product, where you see their face and the face is associated with the product?
Without any doubt, the second method, right? Because once again, the key today to getting a consumer to look at your product is to build that trust. And no better way to build that trust than to show that consumer, the prospective consumer, that there are others who like the product and buy it. But I do want to add one note related to what you said. Is it best to show the face of the person? Right. What my research with literally hundreds of thousands of products and ads shows is that, and this is the interesting thing about data and data science, showing faces can actually be counterproductive. And there's a theory behind that. The theory kind of goes back literally maybe about 100 years, which shows that we as human beings are hardwired to look at the face before anything else among all the stimuli that we're exposed to around us. And the reason for that is in the very early stages of human evolution, that's the only way that we could survive, by looking at the other person's face and trying to assess what that person's intent was. If that intent was to cause harm, you gear up to defend yourself. If that intent was to be a friendly or a companion, you act accordingly. So there's a special part of our brain called the amygdala that is dedicated totally to processing faces. So if you have an ad with a face that's prominent, you can be sure that it's not going to be as effective as an ad without a face. So the key is to show an ad with a person, but with the face not looking at the viewer, but looking away from the viewer. And so that's what my research shows.
Wow, amazing, amazing. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. This week, we're talking about big data and how that data can be used to sell us things or sell us on different ideas. Our guest in the studio is Purush Papadla. He's a professor of marketing at UWM's Lubar School of Business, also recently named co-director of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute, which is a partnership with UWM and Marquette University. Purush, as I was getting ready for this week's program, did a little bit of research on you, and I was very surprised, as I discovered in my data, your background, because here you are world-renowned. You have an amazing, great international reputation for understanding data and how that can be used to do better marketing. But you actually started as what? As an engineer, a mechanical engineer.
Yes, I did.
How in the heck did you end up in this business?
Well, I did start as a mechanical engineer because I was always very interested in math. And that there's nothing that fascinates me more even today than math. But strangely, perhaps surprisingly, along with the love of math, I also have a deep love and passion for creativity because I find math by itself, without any context, not very stimulating. I love math, but I want it to be in a context. So I started out as a mechanical engineer, and I went and worked with a very large truck manufacturer as a design engineer, designing parts for trucks. And I found it extremely monotonous because you really cannot be very creative in designing parts. There are standards and processes. So I was looking for ways out, and I decided to get into something more creative. But before I did that, this is all when I was in India, I thought I'll come for my master's to the U.S. because that's where creativity is, of course, is very widespread. So I came for a master's, of course, in engineering because my undergraduate was in engineering. I did a master's in industrial engineering, and at that time, computers were the new thing when I came, and I was fascinated by computers and how creative you could be in writing computer code, in making computers do things. So I kind of veered off and became a computer designer, writing software to make computers work. But I never gave up my love for creativity, which was mostly available in the marketing context, not in the computer context. So while I was pursuing computers, I also thought I should think about marketing as well. And I finished my master's, and I actually went and looked for and got a job in California to design computer software. When I got the offer, I got a call from Northwestern University inviting me to pursue a PhD in marketing from one of the greatest minds in marketing, Professor Philip Kotler. He's the guru of modern marketing, and he called me and said, "We would love to have you for a PhD." So I just threw my contract down, took the next flight, and went to Evanston, and then I became a marketing professor.
Oh, and look at your career now. You're someone who thought he would be building computers.
That's right.
Is using computers, correct. The data that comes out of those computers. Let's talk a little bit about your additional role working with Northwestern Mutual and the Data Science Institute. What is that going to mean for the people here in Milwaukee to have a wonderful company like Northwestern Mutual making this $30+ million investment in an institute to work around data sciences?
I think it's a very, very big positive step for the Milwaukee community for a number of reasons. One, given how widespread data is, as we talked about at the start of the program, there's no turning back from that, and that's where the jobs are going to be. There's an enormous shortage of professionals who are skilled in analyzing data and pulling insights out of the data for use by businesses or for by use by anyone else. And so one of the goals of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute is to build that data science talent regionally. And so that's going to give our graduates an enormous edge in getting jobs, and of course our region an edge in attracting companies that are looking for those graduates. In addition to that, the Institute's additional goal is to also advance data science as a field itself through research. So our goal is to develop new methodologies, new approaches to analyze even more data, more kinds of data, and come up with new methods to squeeze insights from the data. And in addition to that, I'm very proud of this, that the Institute has a strong commitment for using data science for the good of the community. And that's a very key part of our charter. And we're actually working on some projects to advance that. And one of the first projects that we have begun to work on, and we intend to work on it for quite some time because the complexity of the problem, is to develop methods using data science to address the opioid crisis. So I believe that it can be done, and we have a lot of work to do, but we have identified three other major community projects that we believe can help the community, have a very positive impact on the community, but all of them driven by data science.
One of the beauties of having this partnership here, I mentioned not only UWM, but Marquette University is also involved, is that you're going to have a lot of interactions, relationship building with students.
Yes.
What kind of students are going to be successful in this big field of big data? Are they mathematicians? Are they going to be mechanical engineers like you? And where do the creatives fit in?
Sure. That's an excellent question. And that's one area where we believe that NMDSI, the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute, can make a difference. Ever since the days that we started the Institute and started putting together the Institute's mission and focus and the type of students that we would produce, we made a decision that we are going to work towards developing students who are what you might call both left and right brain talented. The reason for that is very simple. Data science cannot be helpful to any business or any issue unless you have a data scientist who not only understands how to process the data to pull insights, but is able to interpret the data and insights to say, this is what the data is saying. So it requires a good balance of both the creative skills and the mathematical skills. That said, it does not mean that those with purely mathematical skills or creative skills cannot be part of the data science revolution. They will not be misfits. They will have their own role, but the ideal is a mix of the two. So to answer your question, there's no one type of student that would be successful or that should be seen as potentially successful in data science. There could be those who are purely creative. They are extremely, extremely necessary for success in data science because they are the ones who bring that creativity, that ability to interpret the data.
That edge, that quirkiness we were talking about a moment ago.
Exactly. But you also need the other type of person who has the ability to squeeze the data, to analyze it and pull the insights out. So our goal is to actually produce those kind of graduates who are comfortable doing both ideally, but if not, have either the creative skills or the data science, the mathematical skills that they can bring to the table to analyze data and help businesses.
Do you ever worry that there is so much data coming at us, like through a fire hose, that it's going to be all overwhelming, that we will be drowning in these mounds of data, especially as we learn about the Internet of Things, equipment, machinery being attached to the web? Does that scare you at all?
It does not. It does not scare me for the simple reason that, while on the one hand, it seems like a torrent of data coming at you. You are getting deluged by data. The key to benefiting from the data is to bring simple insights to the data to squeeze those insights out. For example, going back to the comment that I made about how we as human beings are hardwired to lock onto a face first, it's those old theories that have been established that have to be brought to this huge amounts of data to bring those insights out. So we should not look at the data as a large mass that's overwhelming. We have to approach it with simple theories that will get those insights out, and that's the key to using that data usefully.
You know, I find it really, really ironic. You talked earlier about the part of our brain that's hardwired to essentially make decisions based on emotion, on that gut feeling of do I trust this person or don't I?
Right.
And that is part of the human condition, right?
Correct.
But it's kind of interesting that while we can't and probably shouldn't push away that emotional reaction, it sounds to me like you can find a way to manage the world in which that emotion is giving us information or data that we can use to be informed on, by how people act.
Oh, absolutely. I think, in fact, you said it very well. I think the another way of saying what I said earlier about how to use the huge amounts of data for good is to understand that at the end of the day, those who are generating the data and interacting the data are people, right? And we as people have emotions, and it's our emotions that are making us do what we do. So if we bring that insight to the data, we are going to be able to better pull information out of the data rather than going at the data with a blunt force. In other words, we need to take the scalpel rather than a hammer to the data. That's when we're going to benefit from that.
I have to tell you, I'm really happy you said that there's room for creatives, because I'm thinking of my own experiences with math. And I'm glad there are people like you who really understand that science. But because some of us, the left brain is full and the right brain not so much.
Yeah, in fact, and that's the one thing that we're really going to stress at UWM in the courses that we launch. We are launching some courses related to data science, and we are trying to build a data science curriculum and program on the campus. The one thing that we are going to focus on is to make sure that students on the campus recognize and feel comfortable with the fact that you do not have to be math savvy or a math expert to be a data scientist. There are other ways to be a good and useful and great data scientist.
Well, we wish you the very best as you embark on this wonderful new adventure of not only continuing your research in marketing using big data, but also in your role as co-director of the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute. Very, very best wishes as you begin this great new project.
Thank you very much, Tom. Enjoyed the conversation.
Purush Papatla, professor of marketing at UWM's Lubar School of Business, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Check us out on the web at WUWM.com. All of our programs here at UWM Today are available as podcasts on the web. Take care. See you next week. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.